Talking Books on News Talk 106 to 108.
They went out of fashion massively just around the turn of the millennium. And, you know, when Franzen was writing his novel, he writes about a guy who just gets rid of all his Frankfurt School books, takes them down to second-hand bookshop and, you know, trades them in for a few quid, and then because he thinks they're irrelevant. And then sort of fast forward into 2008, you know, the massive financial collapse. And there's a massive rise in interest in radical critiques of society. You know, Marx's Das Kapital, the sales set in the past sort of 10 years have been massive, and sales for these guys to a rising, you know, in the Frankfurt School, because their critique of capitalism is now regarded as being something it wasn't before, and it's now regarded as being relevant because, you know, we've witnessed firsthand how we've been exploited by a failing banking system and how we've had to bail out all these banks, and, you know, how our financial system seemed to have worked for our benefit but actually didn't, and we've all suffered through the austerity years. So it makes these books make Frankfurt School seem what they weren't. You know, they're now seem incredibly relevant to us today, even though they've been dead for about the best part of 40 years.
To be happy is to be able to become aware of oneself without fright. The arresting words of German Jewish philosopher, author and essayist Walter Benjamin. Hello, how are you? And you're very welcome to Talking Books. I'm Susan Cahill. It's lovely to have your company this evening. Well, on tonight's show, I've two expansive and hugely engaging writers and thinkers for you to meet. One a financial scholar, the other a cultural critic. Writers with tremendous vision, clarity and originality. Stuart Jeffries unpacks the relevance of the Frankfurt School to how we live today, and William Gritzman, the director of the Yale School of Management, talks his latest book, Money Changes Everything: How Finance Made Civilization Possible, published by Princeton University Press. This is a show about big ideas, consumer culture, and the contribution of finance to modern civilization. But first, who and what is a Frankfurt School?
I'm Stuart Jeffries. I'm a freelance journalist, mostly for The Guardian in London, and I'm the author of two very different books. One was called Mrs. Slocum's Pussy, Growing Up in Front of the Telly, and this one, my new book, is called Grand Hotel Abyss, The Lives of the Frankfurt Schoolmen. It's about this bunch of German Jewish thinkers growing up in the Weimar Republic and how they resisted consumer capitalism and how they were caught up with Hitler and had to go into exile, and how they reflected on those terrible experiences in their lives, and what they thought about the rise of Soviet socialism, and what they thought about how American society worked.
Smashing biography, Stuart. Incredibly stimulating. I have to say it's one of the first group biographies I've ever read. So I enjoyed playing with the pages and getting to know each of the personalities. I mean, you've a very novel way of bringing them all in and out of each other's lives. And they're such complex characters. There's a terrific quote on the book sleeve of the book. It's from Walter Benjamin, the German Jewish philosopher, one of the key members of the Frankfurt School. And he said something on the lines of, the only way of knowing a person is to love them without hope. Thought that was extraordinarily insightful and so relevant. Do you agree with that, or what do you make of it?
Well, I think he's just a completely reckless thinker, and he'll say things that are actually really interesting and embracing, because it's like a bomb rolled into our idea of what love is. You know, love is, you're supposed to be able to share everything with the beloved. You know, you're supposed to think that you can change them, that they can become your soulmate. And he's actually saying the opposite. He's saying that, you know, you can't. Your aspirations to change somebody will not be realised in this world. So it's both romantic and utopian. You know, it's utopian in the sense that the love you have for somebody else is never going to be realized the way you hope it's going to be realized in this fallen world, you know. And it's a terrifying, terrifying thought, but it's rather like a lot of the Frankfurt School's thinking. It's just very, very bracing, you know, about your fundamental beliefs.
So what drew you, Stuart, to the Frankfurt School, and why a group biography to tell their story?
Yeah, I mean, I wrote it just because I was asked to, actually. The publisher suggested this idea to me. And I thought, actually, you know what? I don't know anything about these guys. I'm supremely ill-qualified to write about it. I always say this, you know, I'm three ways unqualified. I'm not German, I'm not Jewish, and I'm not an academic. And most of the writings about the Frankfurt School were written by Germans, Jews, and you know, professors for the most part. What drew me to it was to fill a gap, really, to find out what you know, I'd heard these names like Benjamin and Adorno and Marcus. I didn't really know much about them. So steeping myself in their lives and in their thoughts was, you know, it's quite a seductive thing to be able to do. And I was getting paid to do it, you know, what a treat. So I did that. But what emerged through the writing, I think, was, or rather the research, was thinking that there is an incredible narrative, pretty much the narrative of the 20th century so up till now, telling their life stories and all the travails they went through, you know, be it the sort of growing up in Germany, the rise of Hitler, being forced to leave the homeland and reinvent themselves in the States. You know, they're witnesses to the most important events of the 20th century, and you can tell their life stories through those events and how they change and how their lives are defined by all these awful things that are happening to them. It's interesting as well, you said it's a group of the, and it is. And that's what's really weird about it. You don't really get that sort of, you know, you get a biography of a person, but actually I think to tell, and those have been done in a lot of these cases, a lot of the characters in the book have had their own, you know, massive biographies. But there isn't this sort of momentum all the way through the 20th century with these guys that I think I've got in this book. You know, it's like a great story to tell, and hopefully it's the first time it's been done.
Stuart, I loved reading about Eric Fromm. He was the psychologist of the bunch, and he also was a humanistic philosopher. He's quite an expansive thinker and a very prolific writer. He believed that creativity requires the courage to let go of certainties. I thought that was terrific.
Yeah, yeah. He's lovely. I mean, he fell out with the hardcore of the Frankfurt School because he was kind of a utopian, not a utopian. He believed that we can change. The rest of the Frankfurt School are very pessimistic about human capacity for change, mainly because they've witnessed, you know, the rise of Hitler. So they've got a quite jaundiced perspective on what human life is like. He, apart from anything else, he writes beautifully, as you say, you know, he writes beautifully in his second language. He's writing in English, having reinvented himself. And he's just got this lovely commitment to improving ourselves and becoming better human beings and also better social beings. And he's writing all these sort of things at a time when you would expect people to despair. You expect somebody of his life experiences, he's driven out of Germany, he's a Jew, driven out of Germany, has to reinvent himself in the States. You expect him to despair. And he doesn't, and that's actually, he's one of the more touching characters in the Frankfurt School, really.
Did you read One Dimensional Man, Herbert Marcuse's 1964 book? Presumably you did.
I did indeed, yeah.
And what did you make of it?
Well, it's a fascinating book. There are lots of things in it which are really still pertinent, but, you know, it came out in 64 and it's very much of its time. So he's writing about civil rights struggles and he's writing about, you know, the rise of sort of sexualized culture, you know, the rise of miniskirt and all that kind of stuff. And he's writing, most importantly, I think, about he's trying to ask himself, why isn't there a socialist revolution in these Western countries where everybody's exploited by, you know, capitalism? Why not? And his answer is very simple. We're too comfortable. We've become too comfortable with our washing machines, our TVs and things like that. And it's an indictment of the society he lives in, particularly because he's at that stage in his life. He's exiled and he's living in California and teaching in California. And he kind of loathes lots of stuff about California. So it's this kind of old world, old European critique of this consumerist culture. And it's quite hard to take in some respects because he's very elitist. You know, he's quite snobbish about the culture he's seeing. He doesn't really like American literature. He doesn't really like American cinema. He doesn't understand, as far as I can understand, American pop culture. But at the same time, he nails a lot of things. You know, he's bang on with stuff like racism. He's bang on with stuff like... you know, how people are corrupted by their possessions, which is an abiding theme of the Frankfurt School. But, you know, what is it now? It's 53 years old, that book, and so it does read in some respects in quite a dated way.
Some of the arguments resonate with how we're living today.
Yeah.
We're living through consuming, how we identify with brands rather than other things, how we, you know, our sense of personal identity and so on is very mixed with what we're purchasing and our purchasing power, isn't it?
Absolutely. And I mean, you're dead right. That's what's worth saving about this book. And indeed, a lot of the Frankfurt School, what's relevant to us today about their writing is how they nail us as consumers, you know, how we become people who, we define ourselves not through you know, the books we've read or the conversations we've had or anything like that. We define ourselves through, you know, what brand of iPhone we've got, you know, what kind of model of iPhone we've got, what car we drive and all that sort of stuff. So all the way through the Frankfurt School, they're saying this. They're saying that we have been corrupted. We've been bought off cheap. You know, we've just become consumerist and we don't even realise what's happened to us. We don't realise that we're being exploited by a capitalist system, which has erased the sort of ideological nature of what's happening to us. And that's what's terribly painful to read. And you know, it's absolutely resonant to us right now, I think.
What do you think is Walter Benjamin's contribution to intellectual history? You write very amusingly on his private life. You mention how he was obsessed with love triangles and he caught with his trousers down on lots of different occasions with friends, wives, etc. But he was an extraordinarily complex guy, very prone to depression and despair. You argue that suicide was a spectre that stalked Benjamin's adult life. It's very sad, isn't it, considering all he had to offer?
Absolutely. I mean, one of the great tragedies of the book is that, you know, he died in 1940 on the run from the Gestapo and he took his own life. He got over the Pyrenees, you know, he's fleeing to America. His mates, you know, from the Frankfurt School had already managed to set themselves up in New York. They got an apartment ready for him to move into. And he thought he was going to get caught just as he got over the Pyrenean border from occupied France into Spain. He thought they were going to send him back. And he thought that if he got sent back, he would wind up in a death camp. So he took his own life. And it's one of the great tragedies. But as you say, you know, the specter of suicide was hanging over him throughout his life. He had close friends who were lovers who committed suicide. And he wrote poems about them, very moving poems about them. And he also was part of a German tradition in which lots of people thought about suicide as an option. You know, Goethe's Sorrows of the Young Werther, is, you know, it's steeped in suicide, and suicide is a romantic option. And so, he was a very depressive character, and his writing is always very depressive. And he's the genius behind, you know, I would argue he's the genius behind the whole Frankfurt School operation.
Yeah.
I think so. Everybody else is writing footnotes to his thoughts,
yeah.
Really.
It struck me as I was progressing through the book that in a lot of ways he's the most unrecognised figure of the lot of the Frankfurt School. And when we consider his accomplishments, it's almost that his own peers didn't recognise him within the school. Is that it, you think?
Yeah, perhaps. I mean, he was isolated. Unlike them, you know, he never got a teaching post, university post. He was always intellectual gunslinger in the margins. You know, he was always out there, but never really part of the system he was criticising, you know. Whereas the people who followed him, you know, Adorno and Horkheimer, who owed a great debt to him intellectually, and I think they did recognise the debt that they owed. You know, they were recognised and they were feted and they got tenure and they got all, you know, the academic posts and all that. And he you know, he spent the last 10 years of his life on the run from Nazis and wandering around Europe in this rather picaresque, tragic way, very poor, writing some of the most influential essays, you know, in Marxist theory, in cultural theory, which are still read, you know, very, very closely today and still regarded as having a lot to say to us today. Those articles, those essays he wrote, were ones that were really sort of unpacked into books by later Frankfurt School philosophers. They expanded his gnomic thoughts into great big books, really, and they sort of profited in a way from the ideas that he had when they came back to Germany after the war.
You reference a lovely lovely passage or a lovely few lines from Theodor Adorno. He was one of the other main philosophers of the bunch. And he wrote that for a man who no longer had a homeland, writing became a place to live. I thought that was extraordinarily beautiful. But in terms of inspiration for people who are either, whether they're migrants or refugees, it's a beautiful thought, isn't it?
It's also a very Jewish thought. And, you know, that's why, you know, Judaism is regarded as the religion of the book, because they were thrown out of Jerusalem many times. And so the book became, you know, the portable culture for them. And for Jews, you know, after 1933 in Germany, similarly, you know, and you know, it explains two things, really. It explains, one, why they're people of the book, and two, why they're intellectuals. You know, they're very bright, cultured guys, you know, and they're carrying around, as refugees, as intellectual refugees, all the thoughts. They're also carrying around something really weird as well. They're carrying around their love for the very culture that has thrown them out. All these guys were German, you know, they were German Jews, and they loved German literature. They were steeped in it. And in a way, they when they went to America in exile, they were carrying around German culture almost like a, you know, something they were safeguarding and protecting while it was being defiled by the Nazis. So they're refugees, but they're carrying their culture with them all the way through. It is very touching, as you say, absolutely touching.
You also argue that Walter Benjamin saw technology as having a prosthetic potential, and he was hugely interested, I know, in photography and in film, and I know that you mentioned that Alfred Hitchcock was hugely influenced by him. I'm just wondering, what do you think Walter Benjamin would have make of artificial intelligence today? He has so much to say about technology and how things were evolving. Do you think he would have been troubled by the progresses we've seen in artificial intelligence?
I think he'd be both bewitched and revolted, I think. I think that's what's interestingly dialectical about the way he approaches everything. You know, unlike a lot of the Frankfurt School, he thinks, you know, he sees civilization as having a barbaric underside. And by the same token, he sees barbarism as being civilizing in a way. So when these new art forms like photography and film come up, he thinks, well, actually, these could have a revolutionary potential because they extend our sense perceptions, that they can change the way we perceive reality, and so maybe they'll actually make us see the world in a different way. They might wake us up from our dogmatic slumbers and make us think that revolution is possible. And I think the thing, you know, I don't know for certain if I'm right about it, but, you know, maybe artificial intelligence is a similar kind of thing for him. You know, it might well, had he lived and witnessed, you know, artificial intelligence, he might well have seen it similarly, just as the way the photographic lens extended our perceptions. So artificial intelligence extends our, you know, the way in which we can perceive reality and changes us. He would not necessarily see it as an utterly terrible thing. That said, I think he'd be a proper Marxist, which in a way he was. He'd have been worried that any science can be co-opted and used for purposes that involve the exploitation of masses. And he'd been very sensitive to that.
Stuart, a lot of the guys in the Frankfurt School were, you know, believed that art should have a political purpose. You have spent a large portion of your journalistic career and writing career commenting on art and culture. I'm just wondering, do you think they have a point? Or should art have a political purpose? Should art be art for art's sake?
They say something really weird. I think they say something really weird about art. That Adorno says this. He says this fabulous phrase. He says, behind every work of art lies an uncommitted crime. And it's just an amazing thing. Well, what he means is, I think, is there's a huge energy which is against the status quo in any great work of art. It's actually oppositional to the status quo, to governments. But, and this is where the Frankfurt School are really weird, but art will not overthrow that existing regime. It will not bring about the revolution. It has political purpose, yes, but the political purpose is actually just to indict through fiction or through painting or whatever. It's to indict that regime without actually having any hope of changing it. So all great art is political, it's subversive, but it changes nothing. And it's like what Auden said about poetry, you know, poetry changes nothing. They think that art changes nothing, but nonetheless it's steeped in politics and political objection to the existing order, the powers that be.
How do you understand the concept of false consciousness? It was something that I wrestled with throughout the biography, because in some ways it could be argued that we today are living through or experiencing a sense of false consciousness in how we're living and understanding what our priorities and challenges are and what the issues of the day are, whether it's to do with labour and employment and salaries, that we're not really understanding what the real problems are or what our problems are, that we're somewhat deluded and we're controlled by something greater than ourselves in terms of the capitalist market system. How do you understand all of that? Because it's very complex stuff.
It is complex stuff, but what sort of irritates people, I think, when they read the Frankfurt School, is it seems incredibly patronising. You think, hold on a minute, you guys assume that you can see through all this system, but we can't. You know what made you so intelligent? You know, that's the thing. You know, that they've got some sort of enlightened consciousness, and the rest of us, you know, morons are stuck, you know, being exploited on 0-hour contracts and stuff like that. Nonetheless, that's pretty much what they're saying, and they're pretty much saying that the ideological forces, whether they operate through culture, or the media, or whatever, you know, or even now in the States through the political system itself, you know, they actually the systems of control over your lives are actually erased, and you don't really understand the forces that are exploiting you. And they're very serious about that. That's what they really believe. But the worst thing about it is that. Now, if you're a Marxist, if you're a revolutionary Marxist, you come to believe that your false consciousness as a worker can be, is something that you can rise above. Your consciousness can rise and you can become aware of the exploitation that you're under, and you can change the system once your consciousness has risen, and you know through solidarity with fellow workers. And Frankfurt School is kind of saying, well, that sort of stuff doesn't apply anymore. You know, the false consciousness is throughout the whole advanced industrial system, and people are so atomized, they're so lacking solidarity with each other, that they're doomed to be in a sort of state of false consciousness.
It's a very dismissive concept, but it's an understandable one nonetheless. I'm just wondering, are we not more than our class position in life? There's so much more to a person and their ideas in the world than just their class position and how they understand it all.
You'd hope. I mean, absolutely. That's right.
You would hope.
Yeah, but you know, it's we've got to see where they come from. They come as Jews, fairly excluded in the society even before Nazis arrived. So they're quite sceptical about ordinary working German people. And then Nazi, you know, the Hitler comes to power, and they witness firsthand how a huge population can just be completely brainwashed, really, or rather can be co-opted into a system which is evil, you know. And so they've got, unlike, you know, lots of other Marxists, they don't think that there's much hope. Of course, and I think they would agree with you. You know, yeah, there is more to us than our class basis, but there's also less to us. You know, we're actually people who aren't very wonderful people. I think, you know, we're not cultured, we're fallible, and we're easily manipulated. You know, and that's their vision of humanity, and it's very, very bleak and unremitting. And I'm not saying I buy into the whole thing, but it's a really worthwhile thing to think about and to reflect upon, I think, what the way they approached humanity.
Your final chapter, Stuart, Back from the Abyss, references some stunning writers, I have to say, and hats off to you, Jonathan Frazen, his novel, 2001 novel, The Corrections, and you have The End of History, Francis Fukuyama, and also Alain Badiou's The Rebirth of History. I'm just wondering, within all of those thought-provoking novels and how they have looked upon the Frankfurt School and worked upon some of the ideas, whether it's consumer capitalism and market systems or whatever it is, thinking about art and thinking about political consciousness in the 21st century. I'm just wondering, do you think there's still space for the Frankfurt School in today's political dialogue?
Definitely. I mean, I think they went out of fashion massively just around the turn of the millennium. And, you know, when Franzen was writing his novel, he writes about a guy who just gets rid of all his Frankfurt School books, takes them down to the second-hand bookshop and, you know, trades them in for a few quid, and then because he thinks they're irrelevant. And then sort of fast forward into 2008, you know, the massive financial collapse. And there's a massive rise in interest in radical critiques of society. You know, Marx's Das Kapital, the sales set in the past sort of 10 years have been massive, and sales for these guys to a rising, you know, in the Frankfurt School, because their critique of capitalism is now regarded as being something it wasn't before, and it's now regarded as being relevant because, you know, we've witnessed firsthand how we've been exploited by a failing banking system, and how we've had to bail out all these banks, and, you know, how our financial system seemed to have worked for our benefit but actually didn't, and we've all suffered through the austerity years. So it makes these books make Frankfurt School seem what they weren't, you know, they're now seem incredibly relevant to us today, even though they've been dead for about the best part of 40 years.
But I'm just wondering, do you think we can get all our answers from books, whether it's different types of critical theory from the Frankfurt School, or do you think the answers are to be found in just getting out in life and living it a bit?
Oh, certainly the latter. I mean, the one thing about the Frankfurt School that, you know, always slightly appalls me is how isolated they became. They just became, you know, they did retreat to the Ivory Tower in a sense, and they were co-opted into the German political system after the war in a way which is a bit dubious, and they didn't really, and they were very sceptical about what happened in the late 60s, you know, the student riots and all that kind of stuff, and they were really sceptical about people's capacity to engage together and fight political power. I'm not, you know, I'm not sceptical about that. I think right now, you know, we could do a lot more of that, you know, especially with the sort of forces in America and the forces in Britain that are sort of seem terrible. The thing to do is to unite and resist against them, you know, and rather than just sit in your office and write books about them.
So, Stuart, if you were to select three of the top books of the Frankfurt School for listeners to maybe introduce themselves to some thought-provoking ideas and ways of living, what would those three publications be? You've clearly waded through an enormous amount of literature, some of it fairly complex and woolly, to say the least. So I'm just wondering, what would those three or even five books be?
Well, they're very different. I'd start off with Dialectics with Enlightenment because it's balmy. It's like this mad rant against both fascism and American life, and it almost compares Hitler with Hollywood. So it's just this, you know, it's a really racy, aggressive polemic about the way the world's going. It's written in 1947, so it's just fabulous. Very different book, 1956, I think it was, The Art of Loving by Eric Fromm. Beautiful book.
Excellent choice.
Yeah, I mean, he just loved it. And it's pertinent now because he talks about love as being something which we don't like to think of, something deranging, you know, and something, yeah, we need to learn. We think we can buy love, we think we can buy sex, and we think we can buy, you know, love. And we can't buy love. You have to learn it like a skill. And it's a beautiful book to read. Really recommend it. I think I'd definitely have a go at Marquise's One Dimensional Man. I'd recommend everybody have a go at that. It's like a watered-down Benjamin, and it's less gnomic, and it's a good rant against what's corruption by consumerism. There's a book, I'm trying to think what to recommend for Walter Benjamin, actually, because you've got to read Benjamin. He's just great. But the masterwork in that he wrote called the Arcades Project, which is this vast, sprawling indictment of the birth of Parisian capitalism, is almost, I would say, unreadable. What I would recommend is a book of essays that is called Illuminations, which are just terrific. It's just really beautiful, influential essays about cinema, about photography, and about literature he loves.
And for pedestrian reader, what would you have in mind?
More pedestrian reader. you should read my book. Only in that it's a good way in, just because a lot of this stuff is very tricky. And I think a good way in, you know, read my book and then use it like a ladder you've ascended. You know, kick the ladder away. It's just, these guys, they write beautifully. Okay, but here's the book I left out, and I shouldn't have left out. It's a book called Minima Moralia by Theodore Adorno. It's the most beautiful book you'll ever read. It's just a terrific book of aphorisms and thoughts written by a guy who's had lots of terrible things have happened to him. He's been exiled, he's living in the States and he hates it, and he's reflecting on what life is. It's subtitled Notes on Damaged Life, and it's about how difficult it is to live, and especially how difficult it is to live if you're somebody who's been, you know, so mistreated by everybody. You know, he's a German Jew, he's been exiled, his parents have suffered, he's seen his friends murdered, and he's writing about all those things. It is the most beautiful book, and it's only about sort of 100 pages long, so you could read it in an afternoon.
That was Guardian journalist, writer and cultural critic Stuart Jeffries. Grand Hotel Abyss, The Lives of the Frankfurt School is published by Verso and retails for just under €12 in paperback.
Talking Books on Newstalk 106 to 108.
And you're very welcome back to Talking Books. I'm Susan Cahill. It's lovely to have your company this evening. Okay, let's stick with the theme of money, markets and consumerism and meet with one impressive financial head. Will we always experience stock market crashes, economic bubbles and financial crisis? Do we need a World Bank? And what is the relationship between time and money? In Money Changes Everything, How Finance Made Civilization Possible, William Gritzman argues, finance has stretched the ability of humans to imagine and calculate the future. It has also demanded a deeper understanding and quantification of the past, because history is the fundamental basis for making future predictions. Finance has increasingly made us creatures of time. So have financial systems made the modern world, or have they failed us?
My name is William Getzman. I'm a professor at the Yale School of Management, and I've just written a book called Money Changes Everything, How Finance Made Civilization Possible. I teach investment management at the school, but my interests are quite broad. I work on the economics of art, and I work on the history of stock market crashes and the long-term influence of finance on society.
Really well done on the book, William. It's such a curious and fascinating read. And it's interesting that you say that you're also interested in the finance or economics of art and so on, because you have covered so much historical ground, cultural ground. There's anthropology in this book. It's so many different things. It's not just a book about finance systems or financial systems. I might start with a big wide open question for you. Are financial systems good or bad?
I think that they're neither good nor bad, but they're an essential tool that civilization needs to address the complexities of advanced culture. So you can imagine occasions where such a tool could go awry, but in general, it's like asking whether or not a transportation system is good or bad, or whether whether agriculture is good or bad. It's something that's absolutely necessary for the development of advanced society.
William, what do you say to critics who would argue that financial systems have savaged humanity? Like when we think of these exploitative corporations, we look at the inequalities ever present in our world today. What do you say to all of that?
Well, I would say that we can't really get by very well without them. From time to time in human history, people have imagined and even tried to implement a society that is devoid of financial institutions and intermediaries. But that never has worked out very well. Every society, even the simplest society, has a means to transfer value back and forth through time. And to me, that's the defining characteristic of finance, the ability to save, the ability to borrow from the future or to pass money forward into the future. That's a tool that you have to have if you're going to deal with things like environmental catastrophes. You're going to have to deal with things like old age and the replacement of people's human capital with some other form of subsistence. So no matter where you look, humans have to deal with problems posed by time and aging and the risk of the world they live in, and finance is a way to do that. So it's very easy to throw the baby out with the bathwater and say, well, we're angry at these bankers for making so much money or being part of a financial catastrophe like the recent 2008 events. But, you know, it's just not possible to do without a pension system, for example, or without a way to invest money into productive enterprises that allow trade and agriculture and business of all sorts.
William, one of the aspects of the book that I found particularly interesting was your argument on how financial systems are responsible for the modern conception of time. Now, I found it an extraordinary idea, but I'm not sure did I really get it. So can you talk me through that?
Yes, I've wondered for a long time, what is it about finance that differentiates itself from other aspects of economics? And I came to the conclusion that finance is about time. It's the economics of time. And the fundamental tool of finance is moving value
either backwards or forwards through time. So the simple example I take is a loan, which is the borrower gets money now but repays it sometime in the future. So you borrow money and your future self will pay it back, whereas a lender says, I've got some money now, but I would like to have money in the future, maybe when I get old and I can't work. So the loan allows both of them to be satisfied. One needs money now, one needs money in the future. So even though we can't move ourselves through time, we can move our value, our money through time. And time has one particular feature that is distinctive in economics, which is it involves uncertainty. You know, time goes one direction. Things tend towards entropy. They tend to fall apart. They're unpredictable from one moment to the next. So a lot of the financial tools that we have are designed to control that risk or put bounds on that risk or share that risk in some way. So the essential elements of time, you know, the movement from a period now to later, but also the uncertainty associated with the future, those are the basic things that finance addresses and creates an architecture for us to use and to manage.
Do you think it's either naive or optimistic to think that we learn from all these bailouts and stock market crashes and bubbles? And do you think we learn either whether it's a societies, as employers, organizations, governments? Do you think within the hardship that people experience through these crashes that we get something, we learn more, we understand the world a bit better?
Oh, I think definitely. When you think about it, the world hasn't had too many major financial crashes over the last 200 or 300 years. So the big events stand out as quite traumatic, and we remember them over generations. For example, the crash of 1929 is something that is in the public consciousness. And whenever some new risk emerges about a crash, we're constantly thinking back, casting our minds back to 1929, the Great Depression. And I think the financial crisis of 2008 is going to have that same effect. I think we're going to remember that for generations. So how much do we really learn from them? I think that we've learned a lot about human nature from these events. We understand more about how human enthusiasm and passion can lead to speculation and investment in all kinds of projects. The one thing I also think that we're at a disadvantage in this process, the one thing I think we learn is that the bad events can also create hangover problems. We tend to shut the barn door after the horses have gotten out. So regulation has often followed periods of financial crisis, and it's not clear that that's exactly the right thing to be doing. You know, in the book is a wonderful episode of the very first financial crisis that occurred all around Europe in 1720. Sometimes it's called the South Sea Bubble. Sometimes it's called the Mississippi Bubble. But it was a period when stock prices rose dramatically, and then they crashed down all within the space of a year. A lot of fortunes were made and lost in that moment, but what the Parliament did was to pass laws that stopped people from issuing stock without some certification from Parliament itself. That has been seen as one of the great impediments to the emergence of the Industrial Revolution and the financing of technology. It kind of put the Industrial Revolution on ice for another century until the capital markets were loosened and emerged to be able to finance the technological revolution that really started the modern era.
I loved reading about John Law. You describe him as one of the most interesting figures in the history of finance. He was an unbelievable gambler, absolutely fearless, so resourceful, unbelievably creative. I'd love to have met him now. I'd say he was great crack. What has John Law and the risks he took, how has he impacted on how we do business today?
Well, he was somebody that understood human nature and understood people's desire to gamble and speculate on hopes for the future. And one of the things he did was create a market for shares in Paris for this vast company that he founded called the Mississippi Company. And in some sense, he harnessed people's hopes and beliefs and so forth in the promise of transatlantic commerce. So what I think he also added was a sophisticated understanding of the corporation and how corporations might be created to also sustain the government. The business that he created was really designed to bail out the French government from its vast debts. And the experiment that he launched at that time was also imitated in Great Britain. But when the stock market crashes occurred, that pretty much pushed the world on a different course towards separating the corporate form from the governmental form by and large. Although there are always forces that try and drive the two together and sort of one hand washing the other is sometimes what we see with very large corporations and government these days. It's not as explicit as it was at the time when John Law was conceiving of the company as a way to directly and explicitly aid the government.
You detailed some terrific stories about Chinese thinking on financial systems. And of course, we owe basically the idea of paper money really to the Chinese. I wasn't expecting to read about Confucius, which was an added advantage to your book. You argue that Confucius would be very critical on the possible pay structures of CEOs in large companies today.
Confucius had a theory about human nature, which is that people should be able to internalize an ethical system and then use that as a guidance for their behavior. So the idea is that you should strive to make yourself into somebody of high moral character. And if everybody behaved in a Confucian manner, we wouldn't have anybody cheating, we wouldn't have any crime, and so forth. You can see why Confucianism would be a really useful philosophy in a great bureaucracy where you can't keep tabs on what everybody's doing and you can't audit everybody's account. So in the book, I argue that the Confucian philosophy was an important part of the administrative system of China as it grew into a vast bureaucracy. But the contrasting view is that, well, human nature is not particularly moral. So you have to set up some carrots and sticks for to get people to do things you want, and then punish them if they don't comply. And so those carrots and sticks are what we now call an incentive system in a corporate structure, which is a salary and the threat of being dismissed. So modern corporate managers may not necessarily have that Confucian inner ethical system, but they may manage the company to comply with the goals of the shareholders simply because we've adjusted their salary accordingly. That's one of the basic contrasts, I think, in the world of management science today, which is, do we force people to internalize, or we ask them to internalize an ethical system, or do we get the outcomes we want by presuming the worst and then setting up goals and penalties to achieve that.
Well, what do you advise your students? You're lecturing on management and management theory on how it all operates and works. So where do you sit with it all?
Well, I think my students are quite interested to understand how the financial system and our financial tools relate to the goals of society more broadly. So I get a lot of questions about why do we need a stock market, you know, why do we need banks and so forth. And so this book, in a way, is an answer to that question.
But William, on either a moral or philosophical basis, do you think if we didn't have capital markets and stock market options, banks, insurance companies, all different types of bonds and so on, do you think the world would be a better place? Or do you think that's totally naive?
Oh, I think it would be a worse place. The invention of the loan is something that was a great equalizer. You know, before you could borrow money or to get an outside investor, somebody that had a brilliant idea but no cash would never be able to make that idea a reality. So the financial markets allow external investors to put money with an entrepreneur that has a great idea, and they'll both be better off. So I think the capital markets are very much a tool that promotes growth, but also opportunity for people to advance themselves economically. I really don't see evidence that the financial system itself is something that is responsible for growing inequality. I think what we've seen is that the ability of people to save for the future the way they can now with superannuation and mutual funds and pension funds and so forth has actually made people's economic lives, even if they are of modest income, made their economic lives much less uncertain. So I think I'm a great champion of financial tools. And although in the book, I certainly recognize the places where finance has gone off the rails and created great problems as well.
Last question for you, William. You reference the great Cambridge economist John Maynard Keynes throughout the book, and he's quite an inspirational guy in a lot of different levels. You quote that he argued that the market was driven by animal spirits and that progress was based on excessive optimism. What do you think he got wrong?
Well, I'm a little critical of Keynes, as well as being a great admirer of him. I think what he got right is the notion that this positive animal spirit is really necessary for some leap of progress in terms of financing and building a new technology. So I sort of think of Elon Musk as the modern exemplar of a character that John Maynard Keynes would have seen as important to the society. I think what he got wrong was nearly an embarrassment about capitalism. I would say a sense that somehow it can't be embraced because of past sins. And so, you know, the themes that run throughout his writing have an edge that is critical of people that actually do save and invest. And I think he's got some view that that people shouldn't be hoarding, if you will, their wealth, that they ought to be spending freely. And I think that that's not entirely correct.
And that was financial scholar, art historian and writer William Gwetzman. Money Changes Everything, How Finance Made Civilization Possible is published by Princeton University Press and retails for just under €25 in hardback. I have to say hats off to William. This is one hell of a read. If you're looking for a crash course in the evolution of financial systems, technology and culture, well, this book makes for what I think would be a very robust start. Well, that's it for Talking Books for another week. I hope you enjoyed the show. Now, before I wrap things up tonight, I've a handy little competition for you from the good people at Books Ireland. All you have to do is answer this incredibly straightforward question, and the first email past the post, so to speak, gets an annual subscription to Books Ireland. So here goes. What famous literary day do Dubliners celebrate on the 16th of June? So all you have to do is email your answers to talkingbooks@newstalk.com. Best of luck. Okay, all that's left for me to do now is to say a very big thank you to Ronan Burnock, who helped out with this week's programme, and the lovely Lee Duncan on sound. We've been talking books. I'd like to end this evening's broadcast with the stirring words of British journalist and writer Stuart Jeffries, who in his conclusions to Grand Hotel Abyss, The Lives of the Frankfurt School, writes, "Art, that is to say, has become impossible thanks to the impoverishment of the existence that it sought to honour. Instead, we are left with the readily consumable products of the cultural industry. What Ernest Bloch called the spirit of utopia is expendable in the online culture industry, for which, among others, Steve Jobs, Mark Zuckerberg and Jeff Bezos are responsible, and which gives us more of the same, develops algorithms the better to chain us to our tastes and makes us desire our own domination. In such a customised culture, one that abolishes serendipity, makes a mockery of human dignity and turns human liberation into a terrifying prospect, the best writing of the Frankfurt School still has much to teach us, not least about the impossibility and necessity of thinking differently. Fine words indeed. Good night.
Talking Books on Newstalk 106 to 108.